Good morning, everybody. We look a little bit thin on the ground this morning. Am I wrong?
No.
Okay, some people are tired.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Okay, I just wanted to mention, I should have said at the beginning of the course, but a welcome to Amro and Neha and Frank, because I know you arrived a bit late. But you're extremely welcome, and please come. I think you know who to bother if you miss stuff which you need to catch up on. So bother me, bother the tutors, bother everybody. Okay, it's no bother. So please, please feel free. But a very warm welcome to you. Okay, so we discussed last time the nice properties of geodesic curves. You have a curved manifold with a metric, and then you demand that the tangent vector to the curve be parallel to the curve as you transport it along the curve. And this uniquely specifies, gives you a differential equation for the geodesic. And it's a second order differential equation. So if you specify the initial point and the initial velocity, right, then the curve will just tell you how to move along in x. So it's, so basically every point and every tangent at that point defines a curve, a geodesic curve across the manifold. So these geodesic curves are really nice and very fundamental to Riemannian geometry. And so the next step is to ask what happens if you have two nearby curves. Okay, what happens to two very nearby geodesics? So think about what happens on a sphere. Okay, we already saw a geodesic on a sphere is just a great circle. What happens if I take two nearby great circles on a sphere? Pardon? Initially parallel, yeah. So let me start a little bit away. It's two points, a small separation, and then I'll set their velocity to be nearly parallel. What will happen? Two great circles. They will cross, right? Twice, exactly. So two great circles, right? So just take, okay, so a great circle is the circle with the greatest length. Okay, and so I'll draw one, and then I'll draw another one that, let's say here, is parallel. Okay, but it's going to come down here and cross and go above, right? Oops, and below here. And so there, so two great circles cross, any two great circles cross at two points. That's a reflection of the curvature of the space. That the geodesics, the parallel lines do not remain parallel. Okay, do not remain parallel. They actually meet on a sphere. When you have a space of negative curvature, then parallel lines become a sphere is positive curvature. Space with negative curvature is like a saddle, a hyperboloid, which goes up one way and down the other way. And two parallel lines on hyperboloid actually diverge, get further and further apart. So let's now study this using differential equations. So this is called geodesic deviation. And this leads to the Riemann tensor, which I've already talked about. And basically, the Riemann tensor, we can already anticipate, is going to be something involving second derivatives of metric, which cannot be set equal to zero, as we can do with the metric. We can set the metric to eta. We can set the first derivatives to zero at any point. But we cannot set the second derivatives to zero. That is encoded in this Riemann tensor. So what do we want to do? We want to consider, we've got our manifold. We pick a point and some geodesic. And now I want to consider a nearby geodesic. So geodesic 1, geodesic 2. And I'm going to measure the displacement between the two geodesics. Okay, so let us parameterize them both. So geodesic 1 will be x mu of lambda. Geodesic 2 will be x mu of lambda plus delta x mu of lambda. Okay, so let's see, if I blow this picture up, basically here's the first geodesic. For any given lambda, I have some x mu of lambda, and then the delta x mu is going to be tell me where the other curve is. Okay, and so this curve here, this point here, is x mu of lambda plus delta x mu of lambda. So the idea is to use the same parameter. In fact, let me call it sigma, because I think I called sigma the affine parameter. Okay, so it's a kind of special parameter in which the geodesic equation becomes simple. And I'm going to use the same parameter to parameterize both curves, all right, in this way. So obviously we have d2 d sigma squared of x mu plus gamma mu nu lambda of x of sigma times dx nu d sigma dx lambda d sigma equals 0. That's the first geodesic. And the second geodesic is going to be exactly the same. D by d sigma x nu plus delta x nu d by d sigma x lambda plus delta x lambda equals 0. Yeah. Oh, sorry, you're right. I mean, yeah, sorry, that's d2x. So what I should have written is this d2 x mu d sigma squared equals ordinary derivative. And likewise here, 2 d2 x mu plus delta x mu d sigma squared. Equals d2 d sigma squared equals 0. Okay, so the definition of a geodesic curve is the absolute derivative squared of x mu, which is that quantity, is equal to 0. So we have these two equations for two geodesics, both obeying the geodesic equation with the affine parameter sigma. And so we can difference them. So we just difference, all right, just subtract equation 1 from equation 2. And what we get is the following. D2 delta x mu d sigma squared. And then here, this differs from that by the delta x term. So to work it out, I just take the partial derivative of this with respect to x alpha and contract it with delta x alpha. So I get this plus d alpha gamma mu nu lambda of x delta x alpha dx nu d sigma dx lambda d sigma. So what I'm doing here is difference and keep only first order terms. Keep only first order terms. So terms which are of order delta x, because the idea is that delta x is small. Okay, so I get a term from this, and now I get two terms from over here. So I get plus 2, because the gamma is symmetric. So gamma mu nu lambda delta x nu, d by d sigma, d by d sigma of delta x nu times d by d sigma of x lambda.
The absolute derivative of dx mu d lambda instead of the second absolute derivative?
It's the second. You see, the first absolute derivative of x mu is equal to dx mu d sigma. Because this is a vector.
Plus the connection?
No, not plus the connection.
Okay, because it's not a vector.
X is not a vector. Okay. X is not a vector. Dx is a vector. Okay? And the definition of this. So the definition of this d by d sigma is you take a derivative and correct it to make sure it's a vector. Now, that's already a vector, so you don't need to correct it. So that's already a vector. And then, but when I calculate the second derivative, We first of all take the derivative, d sigma squared, and then we notice this is not a vector. Okay, as we showed before, because you will get factors involving the coordinate transformation which are wrong. Okay, so you have to correct this with gamma dx nu dx lambda. Thanks, I should have said that. Okay, so we differenced these two geodesic equations and we got a new one. And now let us try to calculate. But you see, this new one is not so interesting because the second derivative of delta x nu is not a vector. So now what I have to do is replace this by the absolute derivative of delta x nu. In other words, I've got to put some more connections in. And so let's write, d2 delta x mu d sigma squared is not a vector. So calculate absolute derivative d squared sigma delta x mu. And that's equal to d by d sigma. You see, now, in this case, this is an important point, actually. X mu is not a vector. So note, x mu is not a vector, which is why dx mu d sigma is a vector, and also delta x mu is a vector. Okay, the difference between two curves, this delta x mu, and you can convince yourself of that. Because the curve is x mu of sigma. And then I have my coordinate transformation, x prime mu of x, of sigma. So in the new coordinate system, that's the curve in the new coordinate system. Okay, and if we say right, and so I have so delta x prime mu. So if I have two curves, x1 of sigma and x2 of sigma, I have x1 prime and x2 prime, right? And if I take the difference between them, well, the difference is gotten just by replacing x mu, x prime mu of x plus delta x minus x prime mu of x. Okay? Well, that's equal to, so expand in delta x, this is delta x alpha dx prime mu dx alpha. Right? I just expanded this in delta x. And that's the right coordinate transformation. So delta x mu is a vector. The difference between these two curves is actually a vector. So when I calculate the absolute derivative on that vector, d of delta x mu of sigma, okay, this absolute derivative, it does involve the Christoffel symbol. I've got to correct it. It does involve the connection. I've got to correct it. Okay, so this is d by d sigma of d by d sigma delta x mu plus gamma mu nu lambda delta x nu dx lambda d sigma. Okay, so it's a subtle point, but now I have to calculate this absolute derivative as well of the absolute derivative of delta x mu. And this is equal to, again, d by d sigma plus the Christoffel symbol. But the d by d sigma has to act on the whole thing now. Okay, so this gives you d2 delta x mu d sigma squared plus, now I differentiate this guy. This is a function of x of sigma. So I need alpha dx alpha d sigma delta x nu dx lambda d sigma. So I differentiated this guy. And now I need to differentiate the delta x nu lambda d delta x nu d sigma. And then the dx lambda d sigma. And finally, I differentiate the dx lambda d sigma. D2x lambda d sigma squared. Okay, now I already know from down here what's the differential equation for delta x. So let's call that 1. Or let's call that 1. So this I can substitute using 1. And this gives me minus d rho gamma mu nu lambda delta x rho dx nu d sigma dx lambda d sigma. And I have the minus 2 gamma mu nu lambda dx nu d sigma d delta x lambda d sigma. So let's put all that together.
D
sigma.
Oh, good point. I forgot about all the connection terms. Thank you. Right, so here I just took the second derivative. I need to add all the connection corresponding to this guy acting on this vector. Okay, so yep, so that is plus. Just left us out. Plus gamma mu alpha beta d delta x alpha d sigma dx beta d sigma plus gamma mu alpha beta gamma alpha mu lambda delta x nu dx lambda d sigma dx beta d sigma. Okay, so where did all that come from? Well, the first term came from multiplying gamma. Whenever you take this absolute derivative, you have gamma times the tangent vector to the curve contracted with the thing you're differentiating. So that's what this term is, coming from the first term up here. And then the second term, I need another gamma contracted with that gamma. So here these two indices get contracted. And that's the quantity that that's the vector that I'm taking the absolute derivative of. And here's the curve again. Okay, so that's the complete expression. And I'm replacing this term by that term using the equation for delta x. And so now this equals, so just reorganizing a little bit, minus gamma mu nu lambda rho delta x rho. And let me define x dot mu to be dx mu d sigma, just to make life easier. So x dot nu x dot lambda plus gamma mu rho lambda comma nu x dot nu delta x rho x dot lambda minus gamma mu nu lambda mu nu lambda gamma lambda alpha beta x dot alpha x dot beta. There should be a delta x in there somewhere. Delta x nu plus gamma mu alpha beta gamma alpha nu lambda delta x nu x dot lambda x dot beta. Phew. Okay, so let's see where all these terms came from. You see, I got the derivative of lambda terms from here and there. Okay, these two terms give me these two terms, hopefully. Yeah, this one gives you that term. This one comes from here. Presumably, these gammas, there are two of them, the gammas with d delta x. So they will cancel this guy. There's a minus 2. So this guy cancels these two. Okay, this is symmetric under exchanging the two quantities. And then I have, where did this one go? Seem to have 3.
That cancels instead of the second, instead of the d squared x lambda term.
Oh. Still seem to have too many.
Instead of the squiggle being under the last expression in the top line, it should be under the first expression in the line.
Oh, this one? Okay. Oh, I see. Thanks. Yeah, that's the wrong term completely. And where does that? Oh, and then I'd presumably, what is this? Oh, does this one cancel with something? It must do. Oh, sorry. Here, yeah, I didn't say this. This term is left behind, but this term's rather easy because I can just use this. I can use the geodesic equation for this one, right? So this one gives me minus gamma mu nu lambda delta x nu, and then this guy gives me gamma lambda, well, let me write it here, gamma lambda alpha beta x dot alpha x dot beta. Okay, so this term gives me, using the geodesic equation, okay, gives me a gamma gamma term. So I got one gamma gamma term from here and another one from there. Okay, so this guy is presumably this. Okay, so this one is this. And actually, it's probably the other one because it's got a minus sign. Is that right? It's hard to see when you're up close. And then this one is this one. I hope that's true. Okay. Good. And so we can write this as minus sign gamma mu nu lambda comma rho. So the comma rho, it just means d by dx rho. Delta x rho x dot, oh, sorry. No, I want to leave that out. Minus gamma mu rho nu comma lambda plus gamma mu rho gamma 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 nu lambda gamma mu rho gamma lambda. Really need a computer at this point. Nu delta x rho x dot nu x dot lambda. And that, by definition, is the Riemann tensor times delta x rho x dot nu. Let me write this a little bit differently. X dot nu x dot lambda delta x rho. Okay, painful but rewarding, because what we discovered is that by carefully taking derivatives in such a way as to ensure that the quantity is a tensor, this quantity is definitely a tensor, and by carefully taking derivatives, we ended up with an expression in terms of the gammas, which must be a tensor, okay? Because all of these things are tensors. X dot nu, x dot lambda are tensors, delta x rho is a vector, and so whatever multiplies it has to be a tensor. And so R mu nu lambda rho is a tensor, and it measures the geodesic deviation. And that's called, it's also called the intrinsic curvature. Of the manifold. So that's what Riemann discovered, is that even though the connection itself is not a tensor, when you form this combination from it, those nasty d2x prime dx dx terms all cancel, and this quantity really is a tensor. So let me now show what was going on there. Okay. So I'm going to give you a little exercise to make sure you can do this kind of calculation. Show that. D mu d nu minus d nu d mu of a vector. Let's do it with upstairs indices. So remember, when you calculate the covariant derivative of a vector, you need a plus gamma, plus connection. When you and then you're going to get a tensor with one up, one down. So you're going to need another plus gamma and a minus gamma for the lower index. So compute all of this, and you, what you will find is that it's equal to minus, equal to plus R alpha gamma mu nu V gamma. And likewise for a downstairs, a vector with a downstairs index V alpha, that will give minus R alpha gamma mu nu V gamma. Okay, so this Riemann tensor measures the non-commutativity of the covariant derivative on vectors. Sorry? Oh, whoops. Yeah, sorry, I wrote that too quickly. Thank you. That should have been, there's an alpha here, gamma there. Thanks. Please keep watching me, because the chances of my getting these indices right are pretty small. Okay, so the general rule. Plus one for upper indices. The general rule for the commutator on a tensor. General rule for d mu d nu on a tensor. You get a plus one plus Riemann term for upper indices and a minus R for lower indices. So the Riemann tensor. So in other words, if I have a tensor with two indices here, I'm going to have one of these terms and one of those terms. So Riemann is measuring non-commutativity of covariant derivatives in general. there's no real new information in looking at higher tensors. So obviously, this Riemann tensor is a very important thing. Tells us how curved a space is, space-time is. And let's understand its properties in more detail. So the symmetries of the Riemann tensor to understand the symmetries, it's a good idea to lower that first index. So all the indices look on the same footing. Okay, so you lower that with a metric. And then you can show that this is equal to the following. Second derivative is the metric. We shouldn't be surprised by that. Plus some gamma gamma terms. Okay, so to show this, you need to use g mu alpha g beta nu equals delta mu nu and derivatives of this thereof. So that's a very nice formula. It gives you the Riemann tensor with lower indices in terms of ordinary second derivatives. Okay, so this means here just the ordinary second derivative, d mu d lambda. Okay, comma here denotes ordinary derivative. Comma denotes ordinary derivative, not covariant. So the Riemann tensor is just second derivatives of the metric plus some connection terms. Now, in fact, you can choose a coordinate system, as we've already shown, in which the connection is zero at a point in which gamma alpha beta gamma equals zero at a point. So Riemann is just given by the first term. Now that's very useful because from the symmetries of the first term, you can deduce the symmetries of Riemann in that coordinate system or in those coordinates. So, okay, with that particular choice of coordinates, Riemann is just this. I can read off certain symmetries of this in those coordinates, but any symmetry must be valid in any coordinate system. Any such symmetry will be valid in any coordinate system. Okay, so let me give you an example. Imagine I've got a tensor, F mu nu, and what I can show is that in one particular coordinate system, F mu nu is minus F nu mu, right? That in one particular coordinate system, F is an antisymmetric matrix. Well, it follows, because this is a tensor equation, that that will be true in any coordinate system, right? Because all I do is I say F prime mu nu is dx dx prime, dx dx prime, F, and that must be equal to minus F prime, F prime nu mu. Okay, because it's a tensor equation, so it's going to be valid in any coordinate system. So that's a useful trick, is if you can show something is true in one coordinate system, you can show a tensor equation is true in one coordinate system, then it has to be true in any coordinate system. So the obvious symmetries are the following. Okay, so just taking that first term, the obvious symmetries are the following. I'll write them down and then we'll verify them. A, the Riemann tensor is symmetric under exchanging the first two indices with the second two indices. Mu nu lambda rho equals R lambda rho mu nu. Okay, so that just means take these two and those two and exchange them. Okay, so you can see here, if I exchange mu nu with lambda rho, okay, then this becomes lambda rho mu nu, and this becomes mu nu with lambda rho, so that becomes lambda rho mu nu. Okay, but this term is equal to that term, and this term is equal to that term. And so the Riemann tensor doesn't change. Okay, so that's the first symmetry, that you can flip the first two indices with the second two indices. Secondly, it is antisymmetric under flipping the first two indices or the second two indices. So R mu nu lambda rho, if I just flip these two indices, this is minus R nu mu lambda rho. If I flip the second two indices, it's minus mu nu rho lambda. And if I flip the first indices and the second indices, rho lambda, I get a plus sign. Okay, so this or this. Yeah.
So I have this symmetry rather than red on the right board where you define the Riemann tensor, then that expression will vanish, right?
Say again?
This expression where you have the Riemann tensor times
yes.
X dot mu, X dot lambda.
Yes.
If it is antisymmetric in the exchange of the two lower indices, then
no,
very
good point. But notice it's not zero, because I can write this as, let's lower the index here so that it looks like there. You can lower the index, it's not going to change anything. Good point. X dot mu, X dot lambda. You take one of the first indices and one of the second.
Okay.
It's not antisymmetric under that. Otherwise, it would have vanished. Okay? It's the reason for the antisymmetry you can kind of see here.
Okay,
you can see it here. You see, in this expression, this is obviously antisymmetric under mu goes to nu, And so the Riemann tensor must be anti-symmetric on those two. And then given that I've got the symmetry between the first pair and the second pair, I can flip the first and second pair, and then this first pair must also be anti-symmetric. No, it's not. Well, let's see. It does. You're right. The way I would say it is that only the symmetric part of the Riemann tensor, under exchanging these two indices, will contribute to this equation. Because if this is anti-symmetric in nu and lambda, you don't see it in the geodesic deviation. But that doesn't force Riemann to be symmetric in those two indices. It just means that the that only the symmetric part contributes to the geodesic equation. Sorry? Let's see. I guess we could probably prove that, right? So let's take rho nu nu lambda rho. Maybe it is. Because, so let's do this transformation, mu lambda nu rho, right? If we flip those two. Well, this we know is, I don't think so. You see, I could flip this back by flipping the pairs. I don't think it is. I could flip this back, so this is r nu rho mu lambda. And now I can flip the nu with the rho and the mu with the lambda, rho nu lambda mu, so that's true. But I've flipped these two as well. So no, I don't think it is symmetric.
So if I'm defining my Riemann tensor from this equation right there, so it is uniquely defined up to an anti-symmetric point.
That's correct. Yeah, that's good. From the geodesic equation. So the way I would say it is that the geodesic equation really only, geodesic deviation equation only motivates the existence of a tensor. It doesn't define the tensor. Okay, whereas I think this equation does define it because this is true for any vector V. So if you've got some, if I know this quantity is a tensor for any vector V, that actually tells me what the quantity is. Because I can choose the vector in any direction I like, and the coefficient must be unique. So I think these equations do actually define the Riemann tensor. But or you can just take as a definition this R is equal to that. That defines it. And then you can check that's a tensor. There's another symmetry, which is the most complicated one, and that is cyclicity that Riemann, if I cycle three indices, the last three indices, then the sum is zero. So here cycling means I bring the last one to the second position, the second one to the third, and the third to the fourth. Plus R mu lambda rho nu equals zero. Now that is actually the same statement as the statement that R mu, if I take R mu and anti-symmetrize on the last three indices, then that quantity is zero. You see, you'll remember from when we did electromagnetism that we had an anti-symmetric F mu nu, and then we wrote down the somebody's equation, the second Maxwell equation, which was d alpha f mu nu plus cycles. And that was actually, that equation was completely anti-symmetric on the indices. You see, and those two were equivalent statements. So this is CF d alpha F beta gamma plus cycles was proportional to d alpha F beta gamma anti-symmetrized. And the reason for that, you see, this will have six terms when you anti-symmetrize. You've got to do all six permutations of these indices. The cycles, where I flip the last to the first, involve two permutations. I've got to pull this guy past two, so they give a plus one. The other cycles give a minus one. Okay, but because the tensor was anti-symmetric on the last two indices, then the odd cycles are just minus one times the other ones. Okay, so it's complete. So if you have a tensor which is anti-symmetric on two indices, and either you form the cycles with a third index, or you take the anti-symmetric part with those three indices, it's the same equation. Okay, so how do we check this? Let me just see. I think I did it this morning just to convince myself it's true. Yeah, I think I'll leave it to you to work it out, okay? Just look at that formula. You can do it several ways. You can just plug it into here, literally. Plug that first expression into here. Let's see, I think there's an easy way to do it. Okay, I'm not going to try and check this. Let's call that equation 2 and just check this from 2. There's also a kind of quick way to see this must be true. It looks like a bit of a miracle, but it's not a miracle, this symmetry. So in fact, C follows cyclicity from the Jacobi identity. So if you have any operator at all, then the completely anti-symmetric product, this one, let me write it this way. D mu, d nu, d alpha, anti-symmetrized on some scalar equals d mu, or proportional to, d nu, d sigma let me see what I want to say. Let me just leave it like that. So if I have these three derivative operators, and I form the totally anti-symmetric combination, then this will vanish by the Jacobi identity. Okay, so the Jacobi identity is basically that I have anything plus cycles equals zero. Okay, for any operators A, B, and C, and operator A would be partial covariant derivative with index mu, nu, and B will be with nu, and C will be with alpha, and this is zero. Just write out all the terms, and you'll see that it will that it's identically zero. But you can also calculate this by working out the action of the commutator of two covariant derivatives on a vector given by the first derivative acting on psi, and that turns out to be r gamma alpha mu nu v gamma. And so this, that's not v gamma, that's d gamma psi. D gamma psi for any psi. And that forces R gamma alpha mu nu to be zero. Okay, so the cyclicity is not a fluke, it's a consequence of the Jacobi identity, which is valid for any linear operators. Okay, so now let's work out the number of components of the Riemann tensor, the number of independent okay, so taking into account all of those symmetries, naively, Riemann would have 4 times 4 times 4 times 4 different components. But all those symmetries reduce it to much less than that. Okay, so for a start, we have the Riemann tensor is symmetric. You can think of it as a symmetric matrix where each index is a pair of anti-symmetric indices. Okay? And so that tells you that, so think about a symmetric matrix whose indices take, and let's say we're in D dimensions. Okay, so the indices mu, etc., alpha, take values from 1 to d. And then each one of these is an anti-symmetric matrix. So that would take values d minus 1. Let me see if I got it right. Anti-symmetric matrix is d minus 1 over 2. Because the first index can be d values, the second one has to be d minus 1 because it's anti-symmetric, and divide by 2 because you can flip the 2 and it's the same thing. So whose indices take d minus 1 over 2 values? So we want a symmetric matrix in this number of dimensions, and so that's equal to 1/2. A symmetric matrix has values n, if it's an n by n matrix, it has n times n plus 1 over 2 values. So we get a 1/2 d minus 1 over 2 times d minus 1 over 2 plus 1. And that's equal to 1/8 d minus 1, d squared minus d plus 2, Okay, so taking into account those symmetries A and B, we're left with this number of components. We still need to take into account symmetry C, which reduces the number of components below that. We also need to impose cyclicity symmetry C. And we need to figure out how many equations are here. How many independent equations are constraining the values of the Riemann tensor, given that we've already used these symmetries. So, in fact, equation C is totally antisymmetric on the four indices. Using symmetries A and B. Okay, so let's just try and check that. In fact, I think that's what I checked this morning, is that if you write down symmetry equation C, it's mu nu lambda rho, then you have mu rho nu lambda, then you have mu lambda rho nu. Now the claim is that this equation is complete, this quantity is completely antisymmetric under all these indices. Well, let's just test that. Let's exchange mu with nu. Okay? So this goes to, let's try mu goes to nu. So this gives nu mu lambda rho. And of course, this equals minus that. So things are looking good. All right, so when I flip two indices, I should get minus what I had before. Now this one, it's obvious. Let's flip mu with nu. So this one goes to nu rho mu lambda. And this one goes to, so mu with nu goes to nu lambda rho mu. Okay, but this one, it's a little bit like that one, right? But I can now flip these two, this pair with these, with the other one, right? That's a symmetry, that was symmetry B. So I can write this as rho mu nu lambda. Now it's really close to this, except that these two have been flipped. So I'll do a flip, mu rho nu lambda, and now I've got exactly this term, okay, with a minus sign. So that, this one goes back, this is minus mu nu rho lambda, and this one likewise. You see, I can flip the last two with the first two, so this is equal to mu lambda nu rho. That's close to this, but now I need to flip these two, and I get minus mu lambda rho nu. Okay, so we've proven that the equation is antisymmetric under mu and nu flips. And in fact, it's totally antisymmetric on all the four indices. So obviously, people struggled with this for a long time to discover these symmetries. A lot of it's quite interesting to look at Einstein's original papers, even in the 20th century, and they were arguing about how many components and what are the symmetries and all kinds of things like that, and doing calculations very much like this. So imposing C C adds or amounts to a certain number of extra equations. And the number of equations is the number of components of a completely antisymmetric tensor in d dimensions. So that is d, d minus 1, d minus 2, d minus 3 over 4 factorial equations. And so the number of independent components of Riemann is equal to that number, the 1/8 d minus 1, d squared minus d plus 2, minus d, because the symmetry C imposes some additional constraints on the numbers. So dd minus 1, d minus 2, d minus 3 over 4 factorial. And if you work that out, that is d squared over 12, d squared minus 1, and that's it. Oh, I didn't. I just checked one. You can check. You can check the rest. Yeah. Yeah. I just checked that exchanging mu and nu gives a minus sign. One could check all of them. Yeah. So I've got an equation here. I've got this equation C, and what I know is that, in spite of appearances, C is actually a quantity, let's call it C, mu, nu, rho, lambda, which is completely antisymmetric under those four indices. So then I ask, well, how many new equations are there here? The only new equations are the ones which involve the independent components of C, being an antisymmetric tensor. And that quantity, the 4 factorial, is just the number of different components of a totally antisymmetric four-index tensor. So if we're in 4 dimensions, you know, if d was 4, totally antisymmetric means only has one component, 1, 2, 3, 4. And so that number ought to give 1 if we're in d equals 4, which it does, right? 4, 3, 2, 1 over 4 factorial. But if we're in higher dimensions, you could have 5, 4, 3, 2, or any other combination. Okay, so this is, you know, this is a very sort of tricky business, because you have to be sure that all the symmetries you're imposing are really independent of each other. And so it involves a lot of playing around until you'll convince yourself that you really have understood which constraints are independent of each other, and then impose them all. But this is the result. So if we write d dimensions, the number of components in one dimension, okay, there is no Riemann curvature, right? This is 0, and that makes sense. In one dimension, I just live on a line, and there's no curvature to a line. Okay, so there's no Riemann tensor in one dimension. In 2 dimensions, this number gives 3 times 4 over 12, so there's just 1. And that component is R1212. And so when you have a 2-dimensional sphere, there's only one component of the Riemann tensor. Any 2-dimensional space, there's only one component of the Riemann tensor. In fact, this is this is related to the fact that every two-dimensional space is conformally related to every other. You can, a conformal means you can basically take a metric, which is the flat metric times any function of x, and there's only really one function, and there's only one Riemann, one component of the Riemann tensor. In three dimensions, we have six components of the Riemann tensor, and in four dimensions, the one we're really interested in, there are 20. And the 20 should sound familiar, because we discovered earlier that we could do coordinate transformations in four dimensions to remove everything except 20 different second derivatives of the metric. And the Riemann tensor incorporates those, describes those 20. And so this must have been an amazing moment when Riemann realized this, that this new tensor completely described the curvature of a space. So let me, yeah.
Transformation such that the connection is zero at one point.
Exactly.
Okay, so.
But its derivative is not going to be zero at that point. Yeah.
So the Riemann tensor is also, it's also evaluated at one point.
The Riemann tensor, no, it's a tensor, so it's a function of x.
Right.
But like I said, if I want to understand how many independent, if I want to understand its symmetries, it's actually enough to consider, take it point by point. So I fix some point, and then I pick coordinates at that point so that the gamma is zero. Gamma involves first derivatives of the metric only. So I can pick coordinates where gamma is zero. Then in those coordinates, the Riemann is just the first term. Now, this is completely general, right? Any curved space, any point, I can pick coordinates so that the Riemann is only the first term. Now, if I find some symmetries in the first term, they must be tensor symmetries. Because they're valid in one coordinate system, they will be valid in another coordinate system. An equation like this, you see, the cyclicity equation, if it's valid in one system, it's going to be valid in all systems. There's part of a theorem, which is that if a tensor is zero in one coordinate system, it's zero in all coordinate systems. So you can discover the symmetries by working in a special coordinate symmetry system, but in fact, they must be general. And if you want to do the hard work of checking that all the other terms cancel in any coordinate system, you can do that. Okay, but it's actually guaranteed, just a labor-saving device. So you could work out the whole thing and do all the symmetries, and you'd find that it's just true. All these things are true as identities in any coordinate system. Yeah.
So you said that the Riemann curvature totally describes the curvature of the manifold. How do you know that third derivatives and whatnot, the metric, are not important?
Yeah, let me, well, you see, the Riemann tensor is a unique quantity which involves two derivatives of the metric and encodes all of the information about second derivatives of the metric, which is true in all coordinate systems. Okay, so that's what Riemann does, it's two derivatives. What about three derivatives? Well, that's a question. Can I make all objects involving three derivatives out of things I already know? Now, one of the things you know is the Riemann. So you can take derivatives of Riemann. I believe it's true. David can probably correct me if I'm wrong. I believe it's true that Riemann and derivatives of Riemann encode all the information about higher derivatives as well. I think it's true. Okay. So we can check that, but I'm pretty sure that's true. So in order to check it, what you would have to do is, what would you have to do? I mean, count how many independent third derivatives of the metric there are, count the number of components of derivatives of Riemann, and check that the two thing match. And I'm pretty sure they do. So there really is nothing else specifying curvature than Riemann and derivatives of Riemann. Another way of saying this is that there is a theorem in a similar spirit to to your question. There is a theorem proven by Riemann that if the Riemann tensor equals zero, if there is no Riemann tensor at all for all x, okay, if the Riemann tensor is zero everywhere on the manifold, then g mu nu equals eta mu nu, there exists a coordinate system, then there is, let me write it out. There is a coordinate system okay, so if somebody gives you a G mu nu, you calculate the Riemann tensor, you find it zero everywhere, that implies that actually you're just looking at Minkowski space in some funny coordinate system. So that's a very powerful theorem, and I'm not going to prove it. So as a consequence of this theorem, we say a spacetime is flat. A spacetime is flat if and only if the Riemann tensor is zero. And we say a spacetime is curved if and only if the Riemann tensor is not equal to zero.
Where a manifold was, we said that it has to be locally flat at each point.
Exactly.
It doesn't imply that the Riemann tensor at each point is zero.
No. So locally flat means that it's possible to choose coordinates such that the metric is eta at one point, and the derivatives of the metric, the first derivatives, are zero. That's what locally flat means. That you can pick coordinates in g mu nu equals eta mu nu and g mu nu comma lambda equals zero at that point. The Riemann is exactly in the second derivatives. And we cannot, if Riemann is not zero, we cannot pick coordinates in which the second derivatives of the metric are zero. Only the first derivatives. Great, thank you for all the questions. Now, so I want to end. So you see, we're leading right to Einstein's equations. Riemann discovered the way to describe spacetime curvature, and Einstein wanted to relate the curvature of spacetime to the matter in the spacetime. And essentially, having gone through all this algebra, which Riemann did, and then Einstein and friends had to learn and understand. Having gone through all that, it was basically obvious what the field equations were, okay? And we'll do that next time, that the Einstein field equations are, in a sense, completely obvious. Of course, it's very funny, Einstein got them wrong first time, because you can see that you really have to understand all the symmetries and properties and blah, blah. And the first equations Einstein wrote down were just inconsistent. And so there was a bit of back and forth, and then finally they got them right. But logically, they are absolutely implied by this physical picture that the curvature of spacetime is determined by the matter in the spacetime. So let's do a little bit more algebra. we define some other tensors. This is a tensor constructed from the Riemann tensor. You see, I cannot contract the first two or the second two indices because it was antisymmetric, but I can contract the first and the third. Okay? So I would not get a tensor if I contracted the last two because it was antisymmetric, right? So if I tried to do R lambda rho mu nu g mu nu, well, this would be zero because that's antisymmetric and that's symmetric. But I can contract first with third. It's the same as first with fourth because of the antisymmetry of these two, or second with fourth. So there's one contraction you can do, which produces a tensor, and that's called the Ricci tensor. It is symmetric because you can flip the first pair and the second pair of indices. And so this has 10 components. It's a symmetric 4x4 matrix, and it has 10 components in four dimensions. And then the Ricci scalar. So Ricci is kind of a lucky guy. He got two things named after him. And that is just G alpha beta R alpha beta. And this gives you, this is just one number. Also called the intrinsic curvature scalar. And we say intrinsic because intrinsic is when things only depends on the metric, depends on quantities in the space itself, doesn't depend on how you embed the space into some other space. So intrinsic means depends only on the metric. Okay. And then we have an interesting tensor called the Weyl tensor, which is of great interest nowadays because it's related to conformal symmetry of a spacetime, the symmetry of multiplying the metric by an arbitrary function. And so that is defined this way. The C alpha, beta, mu, nu. It's a tensor constructed from Riemann. By removing the trace. Okay, so when I say trace, you see trace, if I traced on these two indices, I get zero. On these two, I get zero. But if I contract alpha with mu or beta with nu, it's not zero. So I can subtract that out. So let's just write it out. 1/2 g alpha mu r nu beta plus 1/2 g alpha nu r mu beta plus 1/2 g beta mu r nu alpha. So this is literally just subtracting out traces. Minus 1/6 g alpha nu g mu beta r plus 1/6 g alpha mu g nu beta r. So why did I do that? The point of doing that is that C is traceless on any two indices. G alpha mu C alpha beta mu nu equals zero. C is traceless on any two indices. C has 10 independent components. And so roughly speaking, you can think of Riemann is Ricci, which has 10 components, plus Weyl, which has 10 components. And the difference between them is the Ricci components will be completely fixed by the matter, and the Weyl components are the gravitational waves. Okay, so the description of, so this will be fixed by the matter, and these are the gravitational waves. And then there's a theorem, which is that if C alpha, beta, gamma, delta equals 0, if the Weyl tensor is 0, then there exist coordinates in which G mu nu equals omega squared times eta mu nu times eta mu nu. And we say this is a conformal factor. So the spacetime is conformally flat. Okay, so Riemann equals 0 means spacetime is flat. Weyl equals 0 means the spacetime is nearly flat, but it's only non-flat because of one function of x, which is a local sort of scaling. It doesn't change any angles, but it just determines the scale. Okay, any questions? Yeah.
I assume that statement about the number of components is true in any dimensions?
That's a good question. Sorry, this is only in 4D. There are 10 components.
They were calculated today in the tutorial, so.
In any dimension.
In any dimension.
So is this statement true in any dimensions?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so question for the tutorial.
Yeah.
I believe so, just because I haven't heard any different, but I haven't checked it myself. Okay.
You have mentioned that if we use the metric for to describe gravity, then we have some redundancy.
So, yes.
And it seems you also said we can actually use the Riemann tensor to describe the gravity. So is it complete? I mean, I just use the Riemann tensor rather than the metric to describe the gravity.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And there is one. We'll get to this later. For now, there's always the coordinate invariance redundancy. Okay, going to Riemann doesn't really change that. You still have to pick some coordinates. And when you tell me what is the Riemann tensor in numbers, right, at each point on the space, you're telling me what Riemann is in numbers. That depends on your choice of coordinates. So Riemann is not coordinate invariant. Okay, the Ricci scalar is independent of coordinates. Literally, I can say at this spacetime points, Ricci scalar is 10. Everybody in any coordinate system will agree because it's a scalar quantity. But Riemann, nobody will agree. Okay. So then, but what you say, there's a formulation of Einstein equations where you regard the Einstein equations as tying matter to the Ricci tensor, these 10 components. And then you regard that as a constraint. And then the dynamical equations for Weyl, which come from the Bianchi identity, are regarded as dynamical equations for the gravitational waves. So in a sense, you could say that the independent dynamics of gravity is measured by the Weyl components of the Ricci tensor. Okay. So these statements are kind of more or less useful in different contexts. But nothing I've said here relieves you from the problem that whatever you whenever you specify the Riemann tensor, it's going to be in one coordinate system. And you have to just keep in mind that this is supposed to, you know, the equations you write are valid in any system. But we don't have a way of writing them without using coordinates, even though we know the coordinates don't mean anything. Okay. All right, I have to run off.